Beware, I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long way to go.
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the March 2013 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. I'm Shane Armonroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, these shows are going to come out a little bit later than they're supposed to, but that's okay. At least they're still coming. So we're going to fill in March now with part two of the Commodore 64 anniversary show. Last month, we went over the timeline and history of the Commodore 64. This month, we look at the hardware. Not just the Commodore 64, but the peripherals, the hard drives, the floppy drives, the cartridges. We look at all of the great stuff that makes up the legend, the lore, the magic of the Commodore 64. And, of course, we're going to throw in a little bits and bytes this month. I've got a whole bunch of stuff on the backlog I want to cover while it's still news. And all this, much more, this month, right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Well, we've been neglectful of our Bits and Bytes segment over the last couple of months, so let's get right down to it. We've got plenty of goodies to talk about this month. Martin Parrott, regular contributor to Retro Gaming Radio and a good friend of the show, he sent us a link. Remember the old crack or intros or cracktros that you used to see on your favorite games and on your favorite old 8-bit and 16-bit computers? Well, they're back. This time, they play in your browser. The browser is becoming quite a prolific programming hardware machine all on its own, if you will. They've managed to produce some pretty amazing stuff, and now they're running these classic crack screens or intros right in your browser. It's very fun to see some of these actually technologically impressive marvels, if you will. Some of these intros and cracktros were actually better than the game itself that they were on, especially from a coding point of view. These guys were really talented. So now you don't have to load up your favorite emulator, dig out your favorite disk image. Now you can do it right there on your browser. Martin Parrott also submits yet another great Amiga-related goodie, this time in the form of Amiga Music Remixes. That's right, we all know that the Amiga had some of the greatest music and audio of any home computer of all time. And let me tell you what, folks, there are dozens upon dozens of famous games like Turrican 2, Battle Squadron, Pinball Illusions. Let's see, what are some of the other ones on here? The Odyssey Demo, Ghosts and Ghouls, all of these done with some really cool, brand new, funky remixes. I love classic gaming music. I love classic computer music. And I love remixes, so this pretty much matches everything up. And there's absolutely tons of it. Surely everyone can find something great in here. And it's kind of fun. You recognize some of these, like Pinball Dreams, Pinball Illusions. It's like, oh, yeah, I remember that. You know, you think you remember the game, but you don't necessarily remember that quirky little piece of background music that was playing while you were playing the game. This is really nice. It's nice and isolated. They're downloadable right here. No funny business. They're MP3s. They play everywhere. So do yourself a favor. Head over to AmigaRemix.com. Thanks, Martin, for sharing that with us. Now, here's something pretty exciting. Most of you know I'm a huge fan of the game Another World or Out of This World, depending on what area of the globe you come from. There was a spiritual successor actually to that, known as Flashback. Now, a lot of people liked Flashback more than Out of This World. I tended to prefer the former over the latter. However, Flashback is back. Ubisoft is actually releasing a Flashback remake for, I think it's going to be for most major, current consoles. And it's the same sort of game you remember. It's done by the original team. It's sort of a reimagining. The graphics look incredible, but yet it still looks like, it still looks, and by the video that you're going to see if you follow the link, you're going to see it actually has the same feeling as the original game. So, hey, listen, I totally believe games can be remade correctly. They're just not done that way very often. So maybe Flashback will work out that way. That was sent to us by Big Nick Whale. He's one of my regular circled up guys over on Google+. So it was nice to see him contribute. Thanks so much. Now, here's a little something everybody can get behind. Chris Hull, he's a regular contributor to the show. He's the guy that always submits the cool do-it-yourself stuff. He follows all of those do-it-yourself websites, people building their own gaming consoles out of various odd equipment or laying around the house. Well, Chris sent us over a link to something called RaspGC, which is an all-in-one console, an all-in-one gaming console in a suitcase. Now, you can actually go through and look at all the pictures. The idea is to make as many possible consoles into a single suitcase as possible. And he's using the Raspberry Pi as his platform of choice. And you can see the pictures go, and these are labeled pictures, so you can dig through the pictures and exactly see what he's doing, what he's building, how he's building the controller, all this stuff. It kind of goes from start to finish. Building this suitcase with all of this stuff. He puts a screen in there, the whole bit. It's like a spy case, only it's got like all the greatest possible video gaming of all time in it. And like I said, he goes into great detail showing you what he hooked up, how he hooked it up, how he fit it into the suitcase. It's a pretty neat little deal. It's on Imgur Albums, right? So it's sort of like more of a slideshow with notes. But it's still really cool. I mean, I think the Raspberry Pi is a remarkable little device. I need to pick one up myself and check it out and see what I can do with it from an emulation standpoint. But all these guys are proving that you can do pretty much anything you want. I mean, he tricked it out with plexiglass, the whole bit. What an amazing deal. It's a very truly remarkable project if you get an opportunity to look at the pictures. Next up, Jonathan Doyen, regular contributor to the show, has given us a couple of items this month. First off, this is pretty cool. I like when they get around to releasing unfinished games on old platforms. So they've actually released finally Tempest, you know, the old vector graphics game, probably one of the greatest games of all time. Tempest version for the 5200. Right, there was a fairly crappy 2600 version. There was a rumor of a prototype, right, that somebody said, listen, we started a 5200 version of Tempest, but it never got out. Finally, a prototype surfaced on eBay, and then finally somebody got around to dumping it. And now, yes indeed, folks, there is an Atari 5200 version of Tempest. For the 5200. And I'm not going to lie to you, they got screenshots up here. And yeah, I mean, the resolution's a little bit low, but it looks really good. So if you're a 5200 aficionado, and there are many of them kicking around, I don't know, I wonder if this uses, because the 5200 controller, as I recall, the joysticks also acted as spinners, right? So this could be like the absolute perfect platform to play Tempest on. So that's way cool. You can pick that up. It's $50, but you know, that's how it is with these low number of games, you know, low production levels. They got to cover the cost, but it comes in an official cartridge, official case, official instruction set. So it looks like a really neat deal. So if you're a 5200 fan, and if you're a Tempest fan, which you should be, and if you're not, I don't know what to do with you because Tempest rocks, then you want to check out Tempest for the 5200. We'll give you a link. You can pick that up. And Jonathan Doyen also produces us a new version of Donkey Kong for the Intellivision, right? So this is pretty cool. We have here a gentleman by the name of William Muller, and he runs a company called Classic Game Publishers Incorporated. And he is the guy who's responsible for putting out new original titles on Intellivision. Now, the article I got linked here for you will give you sort of a little background on Muller and what he's done with his career. And it also talks to you, of course, about a couple of new titles for the Intellivision. A D2K arcade game, which is essentially a Donkey Kong homage game, and Mindhunter. Both of these are available for about $65 a piece. You've really got to be into it. But again, just like the 5200 project we just talked about, they come with full box art. They come with inserts and all that good stuff, all professionally done. And so that's really good. I like the fact that Retro actually has a market that exists that people will pay that much money for it. That's huge. So apparently the guy's doing pretty well, and he's doing pretty good according to his accountant for a first-year company. But he needs to start paying the bills a little quicker, he says. That's the point. He says, I think the break-even point's about 500 customers. So, listen, help the guy out. Support your Intellivision. I know there's a lot of Inti fans. Now, I'm sorry. I was not an Intellivision fan. I'm sorry. I was a ColecoVision kid. But, I know Intellivision has its large share of fans. So anytime you can support new development on classic hardware, we should probably do it, especially if you're a big fan of that. Well, thank you, Jonathan, for sending those two in. Yes, Chris Hull once again sends us another item. This is a hinged NES case. A hinged NES case. And this is this is another one of these homebrew things. This comes, by the way, from the Hackaday website, Hackaday.com, which I think Chris Hull lives on because he's the one who comes up with all this stuff. This is pretty cool. So this is like a suitcase, another suitcase-looking thing, but it's actually an NES, right? It's made into a suitcase. You have to see the pictures, but it looks like, to the naked eye, when it's closed, it looks like an NES. But you open the thing up, and there's a screen, and it plays actual games the whole bit. So that's way cool. There's a video, a bunch of pictures on how they put it together, of course. Very neat. It's amazing what people will come up with. I wish I had a tenth of the skills to come up with stuff like this, because I would have, like, let's see, what would I have? Let me see. Let's think about this for a minute, because I like to dream about what I would have. So here's what I would have. I'd have a Commodore 64, an Amiga with a hard drive, Amiga with a 2.5-inch hard drive. I would have an Atari 2600. I would have a ColecoVision. And let's see. I think that's it. Those would be the four that I would want to have if I was going to build one of these. Yeah, I think that's what I'd have. A Commodore 64, an Amiga, a 2600, and a ColecoVision. I think I'd be all good to go at that point. Martin Parrott sends us another item here. This is called Amiga. How do you even pronounce it? This is, I'll give you the full name. Amiga Games UAE Launcher. Now, we've talked about this before, but it's been recently upgraded, and we like to give people who are working on this sort of thing as much press as possible. Now, this is called Amigula. Without the dots, it's a little easier to read. Now, what Amigula is a Windows application that lets you manage and enjoy your Amiga games collection. Scan for your games, adds them in a library, search for metadata from the internet. If you are familiar with GameBase, this is sort of the Amiga version of GameBase. And I did get an opportunity to look through it originally when it came through. And, I'm a huge supporter of Amiga Forever, right? And I like what Amiga Forever is doing, but a lot of people don't want to pay for old stuff or emulation-related stuff. So they want a free alternative. Well, that's what this is. And it does look like it's pretty good. It was just something that I was a little more excitable about Amiga Forever. But anyway, check this out. This is located at blitterstudio.com. And again, of course, we will have a link provided for you. Good stuff yet again. Martin Parrott always delivers the goods. Chris Holtz also submits a battery-powered mobile Commodore 64. Now listen, anything that we can do that talks about Commodore 64, I'm all about it. So what do we have here? So this is amazing, all right? I'm not sure that it would be what I would want to end up with, but check this out. So here's what it is. It's a Commodore 64, like the old bread box Commodore 64, right? And what he's put into this thing is an SD card reader, an audio amplifier for built-in sound, a stereo SID chip, Jiffy DOS is coming, and he's adding a battery power pack to it. Now, you should see this thing. It actually has, it's really cool. You should check this out. It's got switches. It's got the screen. Everything is all in one on this thing. And it's cool because it's like a white Commodore 64, so it's not one that looks like all the other bread boxes. But it's got a reset button built in, an amplifier, the LCD, and he tells you about how he mounted all of these things in and onto the box. He's got breakout boards. He shows how he mounted everything. It's way cool. I mean, this is like right up my alley. Anytime you can do something cool with the Commodore 64, I'm all about it. The next article comes from Jonathan Doyen again. This time he's bringing to our attention the Retro N4 console. Now, we've talked about the Retro N consoles before, and these are the ones that do NES, Super Nintendo, Genesis, Game Boy Advance, sort of like an all-in-one type deal. And usually these come in various dubious qualities. At some point in time, I'll probably look and address one of these things just to kind of give you an overview. But remember, you know, I really wasn't a console kid growing up. Especially like the NES Super Nintendo era. I did have a Genesis, as you know, and I did have a Game Boy, the original Game Boy, which I traded up for a Lynx. So this sort of particular device wouldn't be of interest to me, but believe me, it would definitely be of interest to my listeners. So I'm going to give you a link to that. You know, Kickstarter is kind of all the rage these days, right? People are using Kickstarter to kickstart everything from video games to small hardware projects to all the way up to motion pictures, right? But unfortunately, not every Kickstarter project comes into fruition. And sometimes the ones that actually look the coolest are the ones that don't end up getting funded. And this is one of those items, right? It's called the Big Blue. And it was it's the brainchild of the original Echo the Dolphin team. They were looking for $665K to fund this game, and they had a March to April of this year, so they had a 1 month, 35 days to fund the project. They only managed to raise $55,000, right? 867 backers, and what this is an living ocean, right? Let me read you what this was, just because maybe they'll restart it, and maybe we can drum up some interest. You guys can send your letters. Players will experience the ocean like never before. The look and feel of this game will be strikingly beautiful and at the same time mysterious and terrifying. The ocean, especially a million years in the future, is the perfect setting for a unique gameplay experience. This is to be a new aquatic action adventure from the original team. And their goal is to create the most beautiful water and lighting effects ever seen. The team has a lot of experience, and we plan to push it to the limit. And you can look at these pictures, and the jellyfish look incredible. Everything looks incredible. So hopefully, this game would include exploration, quests, collections, and spawning of life forms, action puzzle solving. This sounds like a great game. It sort of sounds like more of a game than, like, say, Endless Ocean on the Wii. It looks amazing. So I'm hoping that at some point maybe they'll re-kickstart this thing again, because it really is cool looking. It really is a cool looking game. And I don't know. It seems to me that the underwater ocean games, or games of that type, either are really, really cheesy, like Jaws was, the video game Jaws, or they're gorgeous, like Endless Ocean or this Big Blue, and they just never take off. So that's really too bad. So I'm really sorry that that didn't work out. But again, maybe we'll see this pop up again. Maybe Kickstarter will be enough of a showcase or a showpiece that maybe a publisher will pick them up. Who knows? Say, now, here's something really original and new. This guy, I believe this is a new contributor. This is called You Versus Them. This is the name of the guy that sent this in. He tells us, fixing E.T. the Extraterrestrial for the Atari 2600. It turns out that E.T. isn't a bad game after all. With a few simple changes, we were able to dramatically improve an already good game by eliminating the most common complaints. With a few additional changes, we were able to clear up any confusion for players who care about the score and were confused about the differences between what the manual claims and what actually happens in the game. Next time someone tells you E.T. for the Atari 2600 is the worst game ever, you can tell them it's not the case. It's been fixed. And you can get it right now and download it. So here is, this is interesting. I think this is fascinating. Let's talk about this for a minute, because E.T. is possibly the most infamous game ever, right? Written by Howard Scott Warshaw, who also wrote one of the best-selling games of all time, which is, of course, Yar's Revenge, Right, Howard Scott Warshaw is an amazing guy, but he had very little time to put together E.T., and it's said that Howard Scott Warshaw put together the greatest and worst game of all time. So is this true? Well, maybe. But now here's the cool part. This is some information straight from the website, which we're going to give you a link to, of course. Why do people hate E.T.? When it was released, it was well ahead of its time. It pioneered a lot of concepts that we take for granted in games, but were unheard of in 1982. So this is interesting. They give a bullet list here. I'm going to read this because I think this is interesting. It was one of the first home video games with a title screen. It featured an open-ended world with gameplay focused on exploration. It was completely non-violent. You can't hurt the bad guys, and they can't hurt you. There isn't even any competition. You could complete the game. There are also several goals you need to complete to win the game. There were multiple ways to complete the goals. You can actually finish the game without falling into a single well. The game not only had an ending, but it also featured an animated cutscene as a reward. The game featured optional additional goals to complete, aka side quests. So why did people not like it? Well, here's the big 4 points. The game seems incredibly complex. This isn't really a problem. Once you learn how to play, it's really very simple. You just need to read the manual or watch a video tutorial. The game is incredibly hard. It's difficult for novices to complete the game even on Mode 3, the easiest setting. Fortunately, this can be fixed. You spend a lot of time accidentally falling into wells. I believe I know the reason this happens to so many people and what can be done to fix it. And E.T. is not green. I'm really surprised this isn't a common complaint. We'll fix that as well. So anyway, so here we go. Why do people accidentally fall into the well? This guy actually breaks it down. This group of people, why do you fall down accidentally into those pits all the time? What's the problem with that? How did they fix it, right? So they go into great detail. They've got assembly language, disassembled code here, showing you what they do, how they change the difficulty. It's really cool, right? Anyway, so check that out. I mean, E.T. has got this huge monolithic history behind it. So this is pretty cool. Check it out. Even if you're not interested in E.T. or playing E.T. again, you might find it fascinating what they did to go in, especially if you got a little programmer bug in you. So thanks, you versus them. Please continue to send those. Good deal. Doug0909, he wrote to me, he's a really big fan of the Odyssey 2, and I think he feels that there's not enough love going on here for the Odyssey 2 platform here at Retro Gaming Radio. And that's through no fault of mine, I might add, because I never had an Odyssey 2 to play with, nor did anybody I know have one whose house I could go over to and play. So I didn't have a lot of exposure to the Odyssey 2. So this gentleman, Doug, would like us to know that there's a site filled with homebrew. There's also all sorts of new development being done for the Odyssey 2. They have a new voice module. They have new games. They have multi-cards. They have a wide variety of new stuff out for the Odyssey 2, and I think he'd like us to know about that. Doug also assures us that the greatest two-player game of all time is on the Odyssey 2. And I think he might have submitted an item for that, so I'm not going to jump ahead. But suffice to say, the Odyssey 2 is alive and well, and Doug would like us to know about it. So check out this site. This is the Retro Game Network, and here's a link to some of the newer stuff that's coming out for the Odyssey 2, right? It was also known, by the way, as the Philips Video Pack in Europe. Now, seeing that, I did not know. Being a retro gamer, you'd think I'd know that, but I did not. All right, what's next here? Here we go. Peter Peterson. Is that really a name? Or is that just a joke? Peter Peterson. Yeah, Peter. Peter Peterson. Peter Peterson. Peter Peter Peterson. All right, so Peter Peterson sends us out a link to a podcast where he claims he shows his wife the most important games of all time and sees what a non-gamer has to say about it. So I went ahead and took a look at this thing. So Peter Peterson and his wife, Jody Peterson, they're from Auckland, New Zealand, and they put together this podcast where he is the gaming expert, she's not, so they take a look at various games and they talk about them together. It's kind of an interesting dynamic. It's definitely something I don't think I've listened to previously before. I only got to kind of skim a couple of them. I've got so much to do. I don't know what to tell you. I can't listen to everything. Plus, I have a standing rule. I try not to listen to other podcasts because as soon as I do, somebody claims I steal stuff from them. So I try to keep myself on the down low when it comes to listening to gaming podcasts. But they've got quite a number of episodes up here. There's 5 episodes total so far. And oddly enough, the very first one they did was the New Zealand story. The second was something called Tower Blocks, which I'm not familiar with. Pong, Portal, and Vice City. And this is all hosted at something called SoundCloud. And I hadn't seen SoundCloud before, so I got a chance to poke around and look at this as well. So that was pretty interesting. So Peter Peterson isn't just Morris Morris. He really is Peter Peterson. So definitely check this out. It sounds like a fairly interesting dynamic. And give it a try. I mean, I'm going to probably download a couple of these and see if I can listen to them on the road and see if I can get something fun out of them, especially the classic stuff, right? They do Pong. Right? And they do New Zealand story. Now, I may not listen to Vice City, but hey, anything about Pong, man, I'm in. Mike Menzel, who I think is also a first-time contributor this month, sends us a little something called Smooth McGroove. Now, I've seen this guy's work before, and I keep forgetting to mention it on the show, so I'm glad somebody put it through. This guy does multi-part a cappella video game music. There's no other way that I can describe it for you than that. And it's kind of cool. What he does is he has videos on YouTube, and there's a game going on in the center, and then there's like 6 or 7 of him, picture in a picture around it. And what he does is he does each part of the song, right? And since I don't actually have permission to play any of this stuff, I probably could have gotten, and he probably would have let me. But I'm not going to play any of it here. But one of the reasons why I forgot to mention this guy, and I feel bad about it because my own personal video game love shouldn't have anything to do with the show. I should be responsible in presenting this stuff to you. Most of what this guy does is old Nintendo stuff, right? He does a lot of NES stuff. He does Zelda stuff. He does Mario stuff. There's a Street Fighter 2 in here, Mega Man 2, Chrono Trigger, mostly like NES and Super NES stuff, which, as you guys know, is just not really my thing. Now, if this guy was doing Commodore 64 stuff, if he was doing the theme from Forbidden Forest, yeah, I'd probably be all over it. But, yeah, I've given the guy his due. Definitely check it out. It's cool. What it is cool, but with me and music, no matter how cool it is, if I'm not into the tune or if I'm not into the source material, this doesn't work out for me. But this is good, though. This is good. And Mike Menzel, thank you for sending that in and helping remind me. Now, recently, and I'm saving this for another show. I'm not going to be talking about it this show. I'm putting together a Commodore 64 shrine. I'm rebuilding my childhood one piece of software, one piece of hardware at a time. That's saved for the end of the Commodore 64 shows. So once we're done covering the anniversary stuff, which I think I have maybe 2 more shows, once I'm done with the anniversary of the Commodore 64, I'm going to take you on a chronicle with stories and adventures about how I put together my Commodore 64 shrine. So in my hunt for things on the Commodore 64 shrine, I spent a little more time over at Lemon 64, which is a fantastic website. All the Lemon stuff's great. Lemon Amiga, Lemon 64. They supply legal downloads. Well, non-illegal downloads. How about that? They put the downloads up, I think, and if somebody tells them they have to take it down, they take it down. But they've got really nicely themed websites, very nice. They were doing really advanced web stuff before everyone else was doing advanced web stuff. So they've got a really nice forum, and I've been kicking it over there. And a guy named Retrograde let me know that he puts together something called the Immortal 64 podcast. And this is dedicated to, quote, the best Sid music the 64 has to offer. Now, it comes to Sid music. I'm all about the Sid music. I'm all about Commodore 64 music. So I told the guy he should submit it to me, and I would talk about it on the show. And so this is at, this is a FeedBurner site, feeds.feedburner.com/IC64, Immortal 64. And so this site looks awfully familiar. Maybe it's just the generic nature of it, but I swear maybe I've talked about this before. But if you go through here, let me see how many episodes the guy's got here. He's got quite a few of them. He's got five episodes here, and these are all very hand cherry picked collections of music. Now, you guys know how I am, right? I'm more a fan, not of the High Voltage Sid collection. I'm a fan of Q-Link music. I'm a fan of Sid Player music. And now, a lot of people don't understand the difference. Let me take just a moment, because we're on the topic anyway. There are typically three types of music on the Commodore 64. Okay, you've got what's called the High Voltage Sid collection, which is a lot of original music, a lot of video game music, a lot of remixes of video game music, that sort of thing. So a lot of this stuff is original work, right? Now, I'm fine with original work. I like it. But for me, the real memories of the Commodore 64 music are in Sid, right? The Sid player from Craig Chamberlain, which, by the way, is a really neat guy. I had an opportunity to email back and forth with him a bunch of years ago. I should try to get him on the show. I think he's kind of a quiet guy. But he created this thing called Sid Player and Sid Editor. Now, this was a Compute Gazette type exclusive, right? So Compute Gazette magazine. And so what happened was they had these cover discs, right? And cover discs aren't new now, but they were back then. And Craig gave away the Sid Player, which is absolutely brilliant. Sid Player was a two-level piano that lit up as it played the music, right? Which is, I mean, that's kind of cool, but it's no big deal. But what made Sid Player amazing was the fact that the music was... You could do original compositions, right? But what people picked up and did with it were they covered pop tunes of the 80s. Now, I'm an 80s kid. I grew up in the 80s. My best years of high school were in the 80s, blah, blah, blah. So to me, 80s music, despite your opinions of it one way or the other, is very nostalgic to me. So there were people like tons of people on Quantum Link. Quantum Link was, of course, the graphical chat BBS, sort of like the early incarnations of America Online. In fact, they were the same people. But that's another story. So what they would do is, this was like one of the first places you could actually trade files. So these incredible composers and artists would go in and take the editor of Sid Player called Sid Edit or Sid Editor. And that was not free. See, Craig was smart. He gave you the player but made you pay for the composer. And it wasn't anything silly. It was like $15. It was shareware stuff. But these guys did amazing things with it. I mean, you know what Sid music sounds like, right? All Sid music has sort of this same kind of synthesizer sound to it, right? Well, they took all of that wacky synthesis and they applied it to music of the day. So there's Battlestar Galactica themes or Star Wars themes. There's popular TV shows. Saint Elsewhere had a fantastic musical version of it, right? So they took TV shows, they took the pop culture music of the time and converted it into Sid music. So that's what I'm into. And I told this retrograde guy, I said, listen, you know, I know most people cherry pick out of the High Voltage Sid collection, which apparently he does. I said, but do yourself a favor and go check some of this stuff out. Because there's amazing renditions of things like Ghostbusters and I'm drawing a blank here because there was just so much great stuff. And if you want to see it, I'll try to remember to put a link in the link collection. I actually recorded YouTube videos of Sid Player. This is emulated, unfortunately, so it sounds better on a real 64. But of probably, I don't know, 20 or 30 songs in two or three different parts so that you could actually get to hear all of these things. And so I'll provide links to that if I can remember it. Now, this guy, of course, is doing these podcasts with the High Voltage Sid Collection and a couple of cherry pick things. So I'm hoping that by talking about it here on the show and by, you know, plugging him and talking to him on the forums, that maybe he'll diversify a little bit and look into that Quantum Link collection and maybe pull some of the great stuff out of there and do a podcast on it. I'd absolutely love that. So that's way cool. Well, listen, gang, that's about 30 minutes or so of Bits and Bytes. We're going to go ahead and stop it there. We've got plenty of show ahead. We've got the full second batch of Commodore 64 anniversary stuff coming right up next. and maybe a little something after that. I haven't decided yet, but you know, the show doesn't get recorded in order, folks. That would make me crazy. So anyway, stick around. You're going to love this new Commodore 64 segment. Stay tuned for more fun right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Last month, we looked at the Commodore 64 from a historical point of view. We looked at the machine, the timeline. We took a look at some of the games, but in reality, what we did is we took a walk down memory lane. Now it's time to get into the hard stuff. And when I say hard stuff, I mean the hardware. After all, that's really what made the Commodore 64 special. There were a number of 8-bit machines out at the time, and yet the Commodore 64 is arguably the most memorable machine of all time. But it wasn't just the machine. It was the hardware around the machine, not just what was inside, but what the machine surrounded itself with, the peripherals, the amazing, fun, innovative expansion devices, all of the things that made the Commodore 64 what it went down in legend as largely revolves around the hardware. So let's talk about that this month. We're going to talk about the architecture, the different machines. We're going to talk a little bit about the machines separately, right? We're going to look at each of the machines, the Commodore 64s, a lot of different Commodore 64s. And then we're going to take a look at the peripherals that made this machine incredible. Let's start off with the core basic Commodore 64. If your first computer was an IBM PC, if your first computer was a Pentium 75, if your first computer was had more than one core processor, the Commodore 64 will not impress you. It starts off in the inside with a 6502 CPU. Now, this CPU was clocked roughly at 1 megahertz. Now, that varied depending on what country you were in, but overall, let's say 1 megahertz. That's not 1 gigahertz, right? That is 1 megahertz. Very, very slow. In fact, if you picked up any electronic device on your desk or your computer table or pretty much anywhere in the house, if you picked up any machine, it is extensively more powerful than the Commodore 64 CPU. But as with most of Commodore's hardware, the real power of Commodore didn't come from the CPU. And you'll also notice that Commodore never went out of their way to make an unusual CPU. 6502, 68000, they took over the counter processors because that's not really where the magic happened with regards to the Commodore 64. So you have a 1 megahertz processor, something that I'm looking around my desk right now. I've got a Nexus 10 tablet. It's got quad-core processing at gigahertz speeds. I've got a Nintendo 3DS sitting here. I've got I've got this little cheap $50 MP3 player that probably has considerably more power in it than the Commodore 64 CPU. Let's start talking about what built on that. We're going to start with the VIC-2 chip. Now, the VIC-2 chip was really a key piece of the pie. And the reason I say that is the VIC-2 chip brought a couple of things to the table that other 8-bit computers did not have. Maximum resolution was 320 by 200, which when you consider we're talking about 1982, 320 by 200 is pretty good, considering when you looked at the Atari 2600 or the other consoles out just before, this was a marked increase in resolution. It also allowed 16 colors, which is something that many machines did not have. They were monochrome or grayscale or green or however you want to put it. 16 colors was a remarkably decent palette to work with. The VIC-2 chip also brought something called hardware sprites. And why is this important? This is huge. Sprites are predefined graphics that you may have heard them called player missile graphics. Essentially, they are little graphics of your player, your enemy, something that's on the screen that needs to move around or interact with other objects. Think of it that way. Let's look at Pac-Man. For example, Pac-Man, in a game of Pac-Man, there's pretty much 5 moving parts. There's 5 sprites. Pac-Man, and the Four Ghosts. Everything else just kind of sits there. Okay, the power pill, the little pills you eat don't pulsate or move or do anything. All you got to do is turn those on and off. The power pills, the energizers, are a little bit, you have to animate those, but that's a pretty basic, no change, keep running it. You don't need a hardware sprite for that. But what you do benefit from hardware sprites are the fact that they can be controlled at the machine level, right? Hardware sprites. Normally, in most of the older computer systems, and actually in a lot of newer computer systems, graphics are controlled by something called blitting or blitter or buffering, right? So there's a whole bunch of other ways to do it. For example, let's say that I wanted to make Pac-Man on a modern day computer. I would not have hardware sprites. There wouldn't be sprites. What I would do is I would use something called double buffering, and I would, the computer's fast enough that I could actually draw an entire frame, right? I could draw every power pellet, I could draw the maze, I could draw all the four ghosts, I could draw Pac-Man in whatever state he's in, I could draw the ghost in whatever state they're in, I can draw the power pellet in whatever state they're in, and I can write that to a buffer that you don't see. And in 30 frames per second speed, I can actually flip that into view, boom, and you see the next frame of the animation. The next nanosecond, I'm in the background redrawing that screen again, updating the positions of the graphics, updating the ghost, updating the Pac-Man, going to the next frame of the animation for the power pellets. And then the second that that's redrawn, I'll flip them again. So this double buffering methodology is the way modern games are written, pretty much, right? And that's how future machines did it. This is also called page flipping. The problem with page flipping or double buffering is that if the machine's not powerful enough, you suffer. Because page flipping is entirely, if you look at it, page flipping or double buffering is really a very laborious way to do it, right? What if instead of me redrawing the entire screen of Pac-Man, right? We know that only the ghosts are going to move. And we also know that there's only so much stuff that's going to move. What if I could tell the computer that ghost is a sprite? I'm not going to redraw the screen every time. That's dumb. I'm going to tell you where that Pac-Man is right now. And 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 now. Right? So you could actually have the computer take care of drawing the graphics. It actually was done by the VIC-2 chip. So no longer were you concerned with this huge overhead. This is why, to be totally honest with you, this is why most 8-bit gaming consoles, even the ColecoVision, didn't do smooth scrolling. They didn't have really scrolling games. This was hard to do because they were locked into doing this sort of double buffering or raster drawing or these other different things. And I'm going to talk about rasters in a minute too. But they were restricted to all these other different ways of doing it. Sprites or player missile graphics, as the Atari people called them. All of this really opened up some doors. You could do some amazing thing with sprites. Hardware sprites. It was simply unobtainable any other way. At least smoothly. Then you had something called raster interrupts. Now, I'm not going to get too deep into this. One, because it's a very complicated topic, and two, because I'm not as familiar with them as I should be. Raster interrupts essentially let you hook into the machine's execution, right? If you look at a high-level language like C# or any of these other languages, everything's compiled, everything gets converted, translated, just-in-time compilation, whatever, right? It's a very different thing. And in the end, you don't have control over anything. You've told the computer what you would like to do. It interprets it. It compiles it. It does its compilation. It changes it into missile, whatever. It does all this stuff. And in the end, the computer does what it wants. Now, it's getting direction from you, but you can't tell the computer the second that you start drawing the screen and the millisecond that it hits this raster line on the screen, I want to stop. I want to stop and redirect your code to my code. That's like low-level ring zero, however you want to call it. That's no-no stuff in today's environment. That brings in so many different security concerns and all this other stuff. So being able to do raster level type interrupts and chain and hooking your own code in to the hardware, that's crazy stuff. But it let them do things that were unbelievable, right? Remember Pac-Man on the Atari 2600? There's a lot of... That's an amazing game for the fact that there's no sprites on there. There's no easy way of drawing five moving objects. It seems crazy. But to have them all move at the same time independently, it required that they use some tricks. And it's a similar type thing. They would actually manually control the drawing on the screen. One line at a time. So, you know how the ghosts flickered sometimes? Like when they were in line with each other, when Pac-Man was in line with them? That flicker was due to the fact that they had to bust into the hardware and trap that beam drawing across the screen and say, listen, I know you're busy, but I also need you to do this over here. So, it's a hack. Pac-Man was a hack on the 2600. It shouldn't have been able to do that. Raster interrupts gave the Commodore 64, the people programming it, this unbelievable low level of power into the graphics subsystem. Okay, so let's move on. I could talk all day about the VIC-2 and how the graphics really made the difference. But let's move on to the specifications of the architecture, shall we? There was 64K of RAM in this Commodore 64, go figure, right? And yet when you turn the computer on, how many bytes did it say it had free, right? 38,911, I think, was the number. I should have wrote that down. That's because it wasn't all usable for BASIC. Now, some programmers got pretty creative and wiped out everything, temporarily speaking. Here's what happened. Essentially, for the computer to run, right, it has to have code that interprets what you want to do, right? BASIC or something. So when you flipped on the Commodore 64, it went out to 20 kilobytes of ROM, and it brought that in, it wrote it to RAM, and it set it up. It copied over things into RAM that it needed for you to work, for you to get work done, right? For example, if you have a computer with a blank hard drive and you turn it on, nothing happens, right? So you may have 8 gigs of memory in that computer, and you turn on the computer, you still have 8 gigs. But you don't have anything doing work for you. So as soon as you load the operating system and the overhead and Microsoft Word and blah, 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 now you have like 4 gigs free. Same thing here, right? The capacity is 64, but you never end up with that much at the end, right? Now, 64 kilobytes of RAM is awfully small. In fact, let me give you an example. If you were to open a Word document, a blank Word document, and type Hello World, and save it to disk. No pictures, no fonts, nothing funky. Just open up a Word document, type in Hello World, and save the document. The Word document you just created is like, it was like 4 or 5 times bigger. Depends on which version of Word you use, right? But it's like 5 times bigger than all the memory in the Commodore 64. So that's the sort of restrictions they had to play with. Ah, the SID chip. How much? Sound interface device. The SID chip, the 6581 chip, is probably, if you could take one thing about the Commodore 64, one, that's all you got. If you could say this is what did it, this is what separated the 64 from everything else, one thing, it'd be the SID chip. That's because, essentially, the SID chip was a full-blown synthesizer, like a Casio keyboard synthesizer. It had all of these sorts of features, and it was all wrapped up into a chip. Now, this was cutting edge. I mean, there was nothing at the time that could touch it. You know, there's arguments, of course. Atari versus Commodore, TRS-80 versus Commodore. The bottom of the truth is, if you get somebody who knows the inside out of the SID chip, they can make music, sound, effects. They can do things that would just even today would go, you'd have to look at it and go, man, that is crazy, insanely good. It offered three voice, all the stuff that you would get with a pro synthesizer system, you know, the whole envelope, attack decay, sustain release. You had a waveform channel too that you could do like white noise with, and they exploited that. It was really, really amazing what they did with this SID chip, and what's the word I'm looking for? It branded the Commodore 64. It branded it much like, how do you know you're playing a Nintendo first party game? How do you know? Forget about whether it's Mario, Wario, Luigi, Princess Peach, Kirby. Forget about all of that. What's the one thing that always ties those games together? Right? Sound. The sound, you take two games from the same era, you know, two NES games, two SNES games, two GameCube games that are all first party, and hold them up together. And what's something that's common, right? The sound effects, the audio. They reused a lot of the same audio sound effects, right? It became the bump sound at the under when you hit the bottom of a cube, right? A question mark cube. That is a distinctive sound. The sound when you get a coin is universal in Nintendo games. It's a branding. The SID chip, the way that it sounded, the music that came out of it, the sound effects that came out of it were brandable. It was something that you could say, I could put three or four pieces of music together, generated all by machines at that time frame, right? And you would go, that's the SID tune. That's the SID song. That's the SID player tune. You could pick it out of a crowd. You could pick it out of a lineup because it is branded. SID was totally amazing. In fact, today, still, I will load up SID player and I will throw in a whole bunch of music and I will just let it play. That is background music while I'm coding. It's memorable. It's something brandable. All right, so now that we've gotten past the basic internal architecture, what's on the outside? Two joystick ports. They smartly made them 9-pin DIN type plugs, which were fully compatible with almost every controller out there that was available at the time, right? You could take your Atari 2600 controller off your console, plug it in, and it worked great. I think you could use a ColecoVision controller. You could use a Sega Genesis controller. You could use a multitude of controllers. The NES was not compatible, but there was a multitude of controllers that the second you unwrapped your Commodore 64, poof, you had a controller in hand that would work. You didn't have to go buy a special one, even though there were some. There was a ROM cartridge slot or a user expansion port. Now, it's called the user port, but really everyone knows it as a cartridge port. You could put all sorts of fun things in there, not just cartridges. We're going to talk more about that later. It also had RF out, which would allow you to connect the Commodore 64 to pretty much any single thing that had a screen at the time. Whether or not your Atari 2600 was plugged into it and it had one of those little black boxes that you had to slide from TV to game, you know what I'm talking about? So you could literally unplug your Atari 2600, which also used RF out, plug your Commodore 64 right in, bing, bang, boom, you're back at the mall. All right? So it had RF out, but they also had a special AV out so that you could use a real monitor, like, say, a 1702 monitor, that would give you higher resolution, better detail, more vibrant colors. And anybody who has or still has a 1702, I have three of them, and they are 30-plus years old, and they all still work. Okay, what's the last 30? Show me another piece of 30-year-old electronic tech that still works. So there you go. It also had an IEEE output, which would allow it to connect floppy drives, printers. You could daisy chain them off of that port. So that was huge. The infrastructure was in place to really expand the Commodore 64, as well as an RS-232 output as well, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And it also had an external power supply plug. Now, this is really, really interesting. It was sort of an oddball thing to do, right? Because if you look at the Commodore PET, if you look at various other machines at the time. It's computers having a brick, an outside brick. Nowadays, everything has an outside brick, right? Your Wii U has an external brick. Your Xbox has an external brick. It's all part of the arrangement now. But the Commodore 64 was very unusual at the time that it offered that. And it really makes sense when you start thinking about it, right? First of all, it took and made your unit smaller, right? The 64 was the old bread box, the bread box layout, and it was smaller. If you had to stuff a power supply in there, it'd be bigger, uglier, right? So first of all, it looked nice. It saved space. It reduced heat, right? Heat kills electronics, especially old electronics, right? So if you don't have this hot, blazing hot heat source right next to your major components, the chances of a heat-related issue was considerably less. So that was smart. Take the brick, put it behind your desk. Who cares if it gets too hot? It's not going to make, you know, it's not going to make your desk hot. It's not going to, you know, melt the resin on the inside of the box. So it was a good, smart thing to do. There's a couple other interesting little pieces about it too. They majorly planned to do it this way because they wanted to be able to easily substitute power supplies based on where you were selling the machine, right? If you put a power supply for American outlets, the 110, right? If you had that built into the machine, you would have to build a separate machine, or at least a good part of it, separately in the other countries. In the case of having an external brick that you could change, all you had to do was take the brick out for America and throw in the European brick, throw in the Asian brick, throw in the Australian brick. Poof, your problem's solved, right? So they also got that as a bonus. And here's an interesting thing. There was it was very carefully designed. These power supplies, by the way, went out fairly frequently, especially the early ones. As they started figuring it out, as per most, you know, engineering scenarios, as they started making more of them, as they started getting returns, as they started working with the power supplies, they realized that they could do some stuff inside to make it better. So they used some sort of an epoxy resin gel, and they coated the whole inside of the brick. Now, there was a whole bunch of people that said the reason they did that was to hide the parts so that people couldn't make cheap third-party knockoffs, which is very possibly true. I mean, it's all about money and dollars, right? But it also, apparently, this gel, this epoxy resin gel, had some very excellent heat dispersal properties. And that was huge, right? That was a huge thing. Anything you could do to cut down in heat back then was huge. So there you have it. That's the basic architecture of a Commodore 64. Now, let's talk about the progression of the Commodore 64 and the machines that followed and what made them different. The original Commodore 64 came out in 1982 with the price tag of $595. Considering that this ink pen I have in my hand might be actually more powerful than a Commodore 64, $595 seemed like an extraordinary amount of money. But what you do have to realize, at 1982, other computers were selling for $995. Not even close to being able to match the power of the Commodore 64. Well underpowered. Green screen, no sound, no gaming, nothing. Those were going for $995, $1,195, $1,495, right? In fact, in one of the commercials, they said they were going to have all of these other computers, like the Apple II and the IBM PC, they were going to have them all tell you what the best value for your money was. And each one of them would come up with Commodore 64. That was like the hook, right? We asked Apple Computer, you know, we asked the Apple IIc what it thought the best value was. And it comes up with, you know, green screen Apple, and it says, Commodore 64, Commodore's. We asked the IBM PC what it thought the best value was. And then it had, you know, that DOS scroll thing going on. It's like, Commodore 64. Truth be told, it was about 10 times the machine for half to a third the price, right? So $595 was a steal. Now, if you want to know more about the the individual historical challenge of the Commodore 64, go back a few episodes and listen to the Jack Tramiel, my memorial that I did for him. That tells you a lot about his life, what his piece was in the entire history. It's worth listening to if you've missed out, because it'll fill in a lot of gaps that I'm not going to come up with again. Now, the Commodore 64 was the logical successor to the incredibly popular Commodore VIC-20. So initially, when the Commodore 64 was constructed by Bob Russell, Bob Yanes, and David A. Zembicki, it was codenamed the VIC-40, right? Twice the computer, VIC-20, VIC-40, right? The estimated construction cost of a Commodore 64, right? So that's huge. So what do you make it for, and how much profit margin is there? That's huge. So $595. Now look at it today. Look at the consoles today, computers today. Consoles were always designed to not make money. They, unless you're Nintendo, and then they're always designed to make money no matter what. But if you look at, say, you know, the Xbox 360, good example, right? It came out for the price of, what, $299, $399, $349? I don't remember what it came out as originally. But they cost a lot more than that amount to make one of these things. So they sold every unit as a loss, and they hoped that the software and the distribution and da-da-da-da-da would be the parts that would make them the money. And that's typical console behavior. Computers have always been a little more conservative, because most of the time when you make a computer, like, say, Commodore, when Broderbund creates a game that runs on the Commodore 64, they didn't buy a development kit from Commodore, so Commodore didn't make that money. They're not paying they may have had a licensing fee to make it run on there, the disk operating system maybe. But my point being is there's not a lot of money to be made after the sale. So they managed in 1982 to have a Commodore 64 cost $135. $135 to build a $595 computer. That's insane, man. What is that? Like I have to do the math, but is that 300% markup, 400% markup? It's like, pardon the expression, a wet dream for any company to be able to walk out the door making that much of a profit margin, man. And they sold so many of these things, right? How did they pull it off? Well, listen to the Tramiel show, right? That will tell you a lot. Essentially, it was called vertical integration. Commodore Business Machines owned almost everything that built this sucker, right? They owned everything. They owned the semiconductor fabrication facilities. They were able to crank this stuff out, you know, go back and listen to it. I mean, I covered it all, but the fact is, in 1982, a $595 computer was making them oodles of cash. Here's the other thing, too, that Commodore sort of invented. There's a whole bunch of golden pathways that all lined up to make the Commodore 64 work. And one of them was Tramiel's brilliant idea of getting these into department stores. Regular everyday people don't go to computer stores. They go to department stores. They buy clothes. They buy pots and pans, blah, blah, blah. As they're walking over to pick up a new fleece jacket, oh my gosh, look there. It's that. That's it. Look at that computer. It's playing games and showing videos. It's amazing. So they got them into Kmart's and then Sears and then Penny's. Every department store carried these things. They weren't carrying IBM PCs. You know why? Because they were $1,495. They were not the market that these department stores needed to move product. $595, we can sell those. Not a problem. In 1988, which is really weird, because now, if you listen back, it was kind of over, you know? Let me see, the exact date here. You could say that it was kind of over around 84, 85, right? It started. 85 saw Quantum Link and all that stuff, and Commodore had tried to stop production. They were like, we got to move forward, man. we want to move. We want to do this Commodore 128. We got all this new hardware. And people are like, nope, more Commodore 64s, more Commodore 64s, more Commodore 64s. So they continue to pump these things out. By in 1988, you're talking 6 years later, man. 6 years later, the Commodore 64 still managed to sell 1.5 million units worldwide. 6 years later. That's crazy. Now, the U.S. dropped off in sales in the early 90s. But, you know, again, you're 1.5 a year, poof, let's do it. But by the early 90s, the U.S. sales dropped off. But oddly enough, the Commodore 64 continued to thrive in lower markets, right? Over in Europe, worldwide. They managed to continue milking Commodore to make more of these things until 1995. All right, let's do some math here. 1982, 1995. What was that, 13 years of Commodore 64 development, of 64 manufacturing? Holy hell. I mean, we can't get through 14 months of a life cycle anymore. 13 years? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So that's the Commodore 64's lifespan. However, there's a little caveat. A couple of new Commodore 64s got released in the mix. But unlike today, where if you were to say a brand new Xbox gets released, or a brand new Nintendo DS, or a brand new Nintendo handheld gets released, these were all essentially the same computers with very, very minor changes, if any. First up was 1986. So you're talking about Commodore's already tried to kill production on this thing. They want the Commodore 64 dead and buried so they can move forward, sell 128s, move better product. So in 1986, they said, okay, listen, this Commodore 64 is not going anywhere. But look, we've got all these fabrication changes. Everything's good. We can make it, we can make the board smaller, better, cheaper, faster. But, you know, we gotta move forward with this. So in 86, they came up with what was called the Commodore 64C. Now, the Commodore 64C disposed of the bread box, the brown beige box, bread box of the Commodore 64, and gave it a sleek look to give it the same sort of feeling as the Commodore 128. You get a Commodore 64 that looks and feels like a 128, it's easier to slide them over to a 128 when it's time, right? One step at a time. Now, what did this offer? As I said before, they had fabrication down to a science by then. You're talking, what, 4 or 5 years? Oh, yeah. Yeah, they had the innards were much, had better integration. They had a brand new SID chip, which wasn't necessarily the best thing. And they packaged it with what they hoped would be the future, something called GEOS, which is a graphical environment operating system. Essentially, if you've ever seen an old black and white Macintosh computer, one of the old Macs from the old days, that's pretty much exactly what GEOS looked like. It was a Windows operating system that ran on an 8-bit computer. Now, GEOS was originally made for the 128, and if you had a Commodore 128 and you had extra RAM and you had 4 disk drives and all of that happy stuff, the GEOS was an amazing tool. I mean, it's still amazing to look at when you look back in 1985 when GEOS came out and go, holy crap, that was in 85? That they had something like that? They did. They even had a mouse. They had a mouse driven, right? So they decided to take the C64C, and that was supposed to be the gateway drug, right? Well, here's your GEOS. Now, it'll run on here, but you really should have a 128, right? Here's, we've managed to make all the parts cheaper. We're going to practically give these things away. Now, the problem is anytime you change the innards, even if your intentions are benign. Remember we talked about all those cool hardware tricks, you know, people tapping into rasters and doing all this other cool stuff? Some of these developers had hit the hardware so hard and exploited every possible nook and cranny, every single nano, micron, millitiny, itsy-bitsy path from the RAM to this, blah, blah. They've exploited it all. So as soon as Commodore changed the blueprints a little bit, put a new SID chip in, all of a sudden, the Commodore C64C took a compatibility hit. And the Commodore 64C is actually about 98% compatible with all the Commodore software that was available at the time. There was also some problems with the SID chip and some fidelity problems. They used a cheaper methodology to create the SID chip, and unfortunately, the fidelity of the SID actually took a hit as well. And you'll see oodles of discussion about that in real audiophile Commodore 64 forums. Now, here was an interesting thing. I think my numbers are a little bit out of order here. Let me take a peek. In 1987, they created something called the C64G. Now, what they were looking for here was a bare bones Commodore 64. I mean, let's make this as cheap as we can. I mean, let's see if we can really ratchet back. Now, this was 1987, right? We're going to make this as cheap as possible. We're going to try to make this the ultimate disposable income sort of situation, right? Essentially, the price is so cheap, it's an impulse buy. This is what we wanted with the Commodore 64G. So, in essence, it was a pretty shoddy box, man. It was the same sort of case, but it was lighter in color. It had the same 98% compatibility thing. And they actually tried to sell it, instead of as a Commodore 64, they marketed it as the Video Super Game 64, right? Now, that did not work out so well. In fact, a few years later, in 1990-91, history's a little fuzzy in there, they took all of these really crappy C64Gs they had rotting on the floor because they sucked and they weren't selling. They took some of those innards, retooled it a little bit, and created, get this, the C64GS, which stood for C64 Gaming System. I'm not kidding. This thing actually existed. No keyboard. A single cartridge port. They stripped off tons of stuff, right? This was a cartridge-based gaming Commodore 64. It came with a 4-on-1 cart that had Fiendish Freddy, International Soccer, Flimbo's Quest, and Klax. Right? There were a lot of ports of games, mostly from tape, right? Because tape didn't require a really complicated file system, right? So they could get that on a cartridge. And they had to find games that did not use the keyboard. Now, most of you who are Commodore 64 aficionados know the keyboard's almost always used, man. Spacebar, function keys, you know, hit enter to continue, that sort of thing. So the ports had to be vetted pretty closely. And, there you go. Now, there were a few companies like Ocean and Codemasters and MicroProse that actually got behind this. They thought it'd be a cool deal, and I'll tell you why. Cartridges couldn't be pirated. Well, they could be, but it would be practically impossible to do so. So they were saying, we might be able to make some serious bank if we ported. We got all the software. We've already wrote the stuff. Let's try to, massage it down and get it working on this game system. They included a very poor controller. And here's what's funny. Most C64 cartridges that existed, because the Commodore 64 had like a huge library of gaming cartridges, right? We talked about. Most of the existing Commodore 64 cartridges were not compatible. So, oops. So now you buy the C64GS, figuring you'll go to some flea markets or garage sales, pick up some dirt cheap Radar Rat Race and Starpost, and play it in here. No go. In fact, at the end, only 28 titles were released, 9 of which were exclusives, which is a pretty good ratio if you think about it. And here's the funny part. Most of the ports of the machine, of course, were removed. That way, you couldn't really use a tape drive or anything else with the unit, so they really wanted to make sure that it couldn't be used as a computer. Oddly enough, if you took the case apart, most of the ports were there. They actually built a case to simply cover the ports. The ports were actually still in there. It was cheaper to leave them in and cover them than to actually remove them. Not the best look for the Commodore 64, to be sure. Now, here's something interesting. We'll talk a little bit about the Commodore 128, but that's not what this is about. The Commodore, the C-128 and the C-128D, and I don't remember what D stood for, if it was deluxe. Real quick, the Commodore 128 looked close to the C-64C. It had that new, fresh, clean, streamlined look. It was backward compatible with the Commodore 64, mostly. And most of the Commodore 128's power went completely unused. Why? Because backward compatibility with Commodore 64 meant most of the time you were using Commodore 64 software on it, and it was not a ubiquitous arrangement where you were in the Commodore 128 screen and you could type, you know, load star, *8, *1, and load a Commodore 64 game. It didn't work that way. Instead, you actually had to boot the computer into Commodore 64, quote, mode. Much like if you have a Wii U now, you have to actually boot to a Wii screen, a Wii interface, in order to use it, right? Same idea. You could do it from software by typing Go64 and hitting Enter on a 128 screen, or you could hold down the Commodore key when you powered up. Guess what most people did when they powered up? They held down the Commodore key, they were in the Commodore 64 mode, so the 128 went kind of lacking. But there's all sorts of cool stuff about the 128 that made it an interesting machine all on its own, and someday we'll talk about it. It did use the new SID chip, like the C64C, which offered the same sort of compatibility and sound fidelity problems, which also plagued that unit as well. So if you wanted to listen to that Skate or Die intro, which is cool as hell, you weren't going to do it on a C64C or a C128D because the guitar riff was gone. Now, we've got two more things to talk about with regards to the Commodore 64 hardware. Recently, there was something called the C64 TV. Now, we've all seen controllers at the store. It's the Pac-Man controller. It's the shape of a Pac-Man. It's got a joystick. You plug it directly into your TV. You can play more or less Pac-Man, Mappy, Rally X, right? So there's a whole bunch of these controllers where you can, plug them right into your TV, you know, TV games, right? Well, Jerry Ellsworth, who we had on the show, fantastic lady. I enjoy her presence. She's remarkable in so many ways. She was brought on board to create an unofficial, right? You know, Commodore was not really around anymore. This was, I don't have a date written down, and I don't know why. But she created a 30-in-1 TV controller. Now, they had Epix Games and Houston Games pretty much all licensed. It was all licensed, right? So they had kind of a limited look at it. And the internals varied a little bit from DTV version 1 to DTV version 2 and 3. Oddly enough, different models offered some very interesting possibilities. Now, here's the deal. Let me give you a quick little overview on it because not a lot of people have seen them, and I'll tell you the more peculiar things about the insides. So this looked like one of the old 64 controllers. It had a reset button on it, and it has four buttons which you could use to be emulating keyboard. That's key, right? Because we've talked about almost every Commodore 64 game needs at least a couple of keystrokes to get through it. So this was pretty cool. They had a full menu, and the menu was all tricked out like an old Commodore 64 demo, and you could play 30 games, which was really more like 20 games, because they took world games and they split the events into like five different games. There was a little bit of shenanigans going on here, but it was real. I mean, it wasn't simulation. It wasn't like the old NES on a chip type garbage. It felt like a real 64. The games that you played, there were no sound problems. Everything, it felt emulated. At worst, it was emulated. At best, it felt like real hardware. Well, it turned out on some of these devices, I don't remember which one, I meant to do more notes, but I think at some point I'm going to cover the C64 TV in greater depth. But some of these, you could open the thing up and there were actually mount points, solder points on the board where you could solder in a keyboard, a disk drive, even an SD card reader. All of this stuff was right underneath the case, man. I've seen these things tricked out where you could actually use like a compact flash card, dump like 9 bajillion Commodore 64 games on there and pop it in. Hit the reset button. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. You could turn into a full C64. You could see pictures of people. This is amazing. One guy actually took, what did he do? He took the internals. God, I wish I had a link to this. He took the internals out of the C64 TV, the DTV unit, took the internals out, mounted them in the free space of a 1541 disk drive, right? Put joystick ports sticking out the side and some sort of a video out, I don't remember what it was, out the side of the case, and then he rigged the internals of the 1541 disk drive to work on the DTV card. So what he had was a 1541 that had a C64 inside that you could plug a joystick onto and then plug it into your TV and then run real Commodore 64 software. It was crazy. I wish I had something for that. But that's sort of the most recent incarnation of real C64 software. Now, you're probably wondering, Shane, you forgot something, man. You were going to talk about one more thing. And the one more thing is, what happened to the SX64? I can't believe you didn't talk about that. Well, are you kidding me? The SX64, pardon the expression, is still a wet dream of mine to actually own one. And I passed one up for like $50. I'm an idiot. All right, let's talk about the C64. The SX64, I'm sorry. January of 1983. Now, this was a year. This was 1 year after the C64 came out. Somebody thought up, you know what? We need a C64 you can take with you, right? So they created a suitcase Commodore 64 known as the SX64. This was affectionately known as a luggable. When I say luggable, the thing weighed 23 pounds. Now, the next time you're complaining and whining that your new tablet happens to weigh 3 ounces more than the next tablet, remember, please, back to the SX64 that clocked in at 23 pounds. Now, inside this big black box was a 5-inch color monitor, color screen. The clarity was amazing. It's an amazing-looking monitor. I don't know what they put in there. It also had a built-in 1541 disk drive. Because of the small screen, they inverted the color. They made the background white instead of the blue, and they made blue text on white, which gave a very good contrast for the screen. It looked really nice. They did remove the cassette port for the data set, and they removed the RF port. I mean, why on earth are you going to plug an SX64 into your TV, right? Well, I guess there's a couple reasons. Now, there were some compatibility issues across the board. Remember I said that anytime you start messing with the basics, when you start messing with the hardware configuration, something bad's likely to happen or there's a problem. Well, the 1541 drive that was in there was not 100% compatible. There were handfuls of games that used advanced protection that would not run on that drive. Also, the cartridge port had problems. Some of it was basic compatibility. Some of it had to do with the way that the hardware was manufactured. Certain cartridges would not fit into the cartridge port, so it was kind of sucky. This sucker ran for a grand. That was $1,000, which is unusual because that sounds like a heck of a lot of money. In reality, for a portable computer, essentially not a laptop, but a luggable, a mobile computer of that nature and stature, in 1983, $1,000 was actually a pretty good price. The other thing interesting, they got rid of the brick and they brought it into the unit. So that nice hot brick we were talking about, they put it right inside the computer, which probably did not help for reliability problems. In fact, I'm 99% sure, this goes way back, folks, that the power brick heat inside the box caused 1541 disk drive failures fairly regularly. So a lot of people had a little cooling fan they put on top of the unit to stop that from happening, which really sort of defeats the purpose of a luggable if you have to carry a fan around with you. They also was going to have a DX version. This was the SX64. They were going to have a DX64 version that had two floppy drives. Now, what really was a cool design, and people hate this because it's very proprietary, and if you ever need to get another one of these things, you can just plain forget about it. The SX64's faceplate, right? So if you're looking at the box, right? So take this huge box. I don't know the exact dimensions, but take a box, put it, it's a rectangle, put it on the ground, go to one end of the rectangle, put a big, giant, thick handle on it. The handle also acted as a stand when you lowered the handle and you could slide it underneath the box. It would actually prop up the box and make it look at you like eye level type thing. The faceplate was the keyboard. I thought it was a brilliant design myself, and I'm still in love with it, even though I understand that it's hard to get parts. But you would essentially put your fingers in two clips, and this keyboard would just drop right off. And it was detachable, so you could put your luggable on the table and the keyboard on your lap. Now, we wouldn't see that again until the Commodore 128D, which had a detachable keyboard, right? So this was kind of innovative. I mean, this was like a business thing. Right, you have a keyboard on your lap. That's crazy. But of course, again, like I said, the very non-standard keyboard, and the keyboard was really cool. It was a very soft key thing. I think one of the other Commodores, one of the other Commodore computers, had the same keyboard. I want to say it was the C16. Maybe it was the Plus 4. I don't remember. Anyway, one of them had the same basic keyboard inside. It felt the same. So it was really cool. Very cool. So how much fun is that? So the SX64, unfortunately, did not sell well, obviously, for obvious reasons. And the problem is they made a lot of them. So you can still get these things. You could probably go to eBay right now and get one of these things. In fact, we'll do it right now just for fun. We're doing the show, but I'm going to hop on anyway because that would be fun. I'm going to go to eBay and see if right now you can get an SX64 and what they're running for. Now, remember, I could have picked one of these up for $50. God, I wish I had. All right, so let's see what the Commodore SX64 is. Here we go. They've got one here. It's pretty much all in place here. It's all here. It looks great. They want $299 for it. Here's one. Wow, this one's up for $3.25, but I bet that doesn't work all that well. Here's another one, $207 with 13 bids. So they're going for a couple hundred bucks now. But they're amazing. You should look them up. They're so fun. good stuff. So yeah, the SX64 is still on my bucket list. I need to own one. So if you've got one laying around and you're not going to use it and it still works, let me know. Maybe I'll make you a deal. And that's going to wrap up our look at the hardware itself, the Commodore 64, its incarnations, what came out, and all the different sort of models and interpretations of the C64. Next up, we're going to talk about the peripherals, because I'll be honest with you, the machine itself is not nearly as exciting as what you plugged into it, and there's a lot of stuff to talk about, so we're going to get to that next right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Well, we hope you enjoyed the show this month. That's going to wrap up this edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Next month, we'll be continuing our multi-part series on the Commodore 64 for its special 30th year anniversary. And next month, we'll be looking at the software magic that makes any hardware go. We'll be looking at the Commodore 64's greatest games and applications next month right here on the show. And remember, bits and bytes are articles submitted by listeners just like you. So don't forget, hit RetroGamingRadio.com, click the Submit Bits and Bytes button, and off you go. We'll get your articles, we'll review them, and we'll read them here on the air. Again, hope you enjoyed the show. Be looking for some great changes over at RetroGamingRadio.com. We're going to be opening our mobile site soon. You can check it out right now at m.RetroGamingRadio.com. It's still kind of in beta, but you're welcome to take a look at it. All sorts of new fun stuff always going on right here on Retro Gaming Radio. So this is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio saying, until next time, keep it retro.